Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to episode 443, which is a best of rerun of an episode from 2011 with my guest, Rob Delaney. Today's episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Turn your great idea into a reality with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project, whether you're showcasing your work or selling products of any kind. With beautiful templates and the ability to customize just about anything, you can easily make a beautiful website yourself. And if you do get stuck, Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer service is there to help. So head to squarespace.com/mental for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code MENTAL to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. I want to also give a shout out to our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. They provide online counseling. I'm a huge fan of it. It's been helping me weekly for years. If you want to try it, I highly recommend it. Go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the /mental so they know you came from this podcast. And just fill out a questionnaire. They'll match you up with a betterhelp.com counselor, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is a good fit for you and you need to be over 18. Today's episode is also sponsored by the Calm app. We all know that stress is a mofo, and it's a part of life, and so let's face it, and let's find a way to deal with it. Calm is the number one app to help you reduce your anxiety and stress and help you sleep better. More than 40 million people around the world have downloaded it. If you guys go to calm.com/mental, make sure to include /mental, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day. Sleep stories, which are bedtime stories for adults, and they help you relax. Head to the fields of southern France, the lavender fields with Stephen Fry, or explore the moonlit jungles of Africa with Leona Lewis. Their adult bedtime stories are really cool, really soothing. And I don't know anybody that couldn't use a little more soothing in their life. They also have soothing music, if that's your thing, if you're into that kind of thing. So right now, you guys, the listeners, get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/mental. That's calm.com/mental. Get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/mental. Get calm and stop stressing. And here now is that episode with Rob Delaney from 2011. Our interview today with Rob Delaney is a little on the short side for this show. Probably for a lot of shows, it wouldn't be considered short. It's about 45 minutes. I would have liked to have spent more time with him, but he's a super busy guy, and we had to kind of squeeze this into his busy schedule. But I think it's a great interview, and I'm really happy that he was able to come by and talk with us. He's got a really interesting story and I think a great perspective. Many thanks to the people at the Onion AV Club. They picked our podcast as one of the top 10 of 2011. And they've given us great support along the way. And I really appreciate that. It I feel really honored to be put on that list with so many other great podcasts. And I want to thank all of my guests who helped made that possible over the last year. You guys know who you are. Some of you listen to the show. So if you're listening, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. As I've mentioned, there is the website for this show is mentalpod.com, and there's a survey that you can take on there. There's two surveys, actually. There's the basic survey, and then there's the shame and secrets survey. And I find myself really drawn to the reading. And you guys can not only take the survey, but you can see how other people filled out the survey. And I find myself really drawn to the shame and secrets survey because I relate to so much of what people write, what people feel shame about in that one. And I want to read one that I don't necessarily relate to, but I relate to the feelings that this guy has. His name is Caged Lion. I have people kind of put a nickname down because obviously they don't want to be referred to by their actual name. He is straight. He's in his 30s. His environment that he was raised in was totally chaotic. He was the victim of sexual abuse, and he reported it. And he writes, I was terrified that it was my fault. What are your deepest, darkest thoughts? Not things you would act on, but things you're ashamed to admit you think about. He writes, sometimes I think that an abortion would have been the best for everyone involved. It's pretty fucking harsh. We get some harsh thoughts on this podcast, and that's right up there. That's some deep, deep self-hatred. What are your deepest, darkest secrets, things you have done or things that have happened to you? He writes, I was sexually abused by my older siblings starting when I was a preteen. After several years, one of them became pregnant. When this was discovered, social services intervened. I felt that I was to blame for all of it. One day, a state police detective and a social worker came to my house looking for my parents. I was home alone. I just knew that they were there to arrest me. They said they would return later. I closed the door and started to shake uncontrollably. To this day, I get nervous around police. After much chaos, I was living in the same home with the same people, ostracized, and helping to raise a baby that I resented for the first year and loved dearly from then on. The secret was very poorly kept in the family. He puts in parentheses, not at all. Outside the family, everyone suspected, and school was hell. I was the uncle for several years until I was sued for paternity and child support. I'm raising my daughter on my own now. I have no contact with my family. I got married, had more children, got divorced. I'm in a relationship now. Do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes, I always feel that I am guilty of something, even when there is nothing to be guilty about. I feel like I'm a poor parent. I feel overwhelmed most days. I am terrified to move forward with anything in my life. I don't have answers for 90% of the stuff on this show. What I do know is sometimes I'll hear somebody's story, and the one thing I do know for sure is that person could benefit from talking to a professional and talking about what is going on and letting some of that steam out. And you sound like a prime candidate who would benefit from going and getting some help. So I encourage you. You know, one of the things that comes up so much in this survey is sex between siblings, which I would imagine, of course, people would feel secretive and shameful about it. But I think it happens a lot more than people talk about. And the other thing, I think the other reason I wanted to read this survey respondent to was sexual, I don't know what the word would be, molestation by females is so much more widely it is happening so much more than people think that it is. I can't tell you how many friends of mine were molested by a female babysitter. And I don't say that to to try to take women down or make them look bad. But I say it because I think a lot of men minimize it because they think, oh, if you had an erection, that means that you wanted it. And that's not the case. Your body can be turned on and your soul can be violated at the same time. And I think that this guy, I think that's what he's experiencing is, you know, he's blaming himself just because he got an erection and had sex with his older sister. That doesn't make what happens right. His letter is a little vague, so I can't really, I'm assuming it's his older sister. I don't know why he would have been arrested for that. But I don't think we need to know really any of that stuff to know that he could benefit from going and talking to somebody about this and getting help. And, you know, the one thing if I've taken anything out of all my years of therapy and support groups and psychiatrist visits is the things that I assumed that were broken and irreparable about me were not. They were just unhealed. And never underestimate the power of talking and connecting to another human being, especially a professional, to help you turn a corner and to help let a little glimmer of light into that darkness.
Everybody yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with Twitter monster Rob Delaney. Do you mind being called a Twitter monster?
You can call me any kind of monster you want.
Rob and I met briefly at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater probably, 3-4 years ago? We were on the same show?
Yeah, I think around 4 years ago.
And having a pot-addled brain could vaguely remember meeting anybody, so Rob had to remind me when I asked him to come do the podcast. One of the reasons I wanted to have you come do it is when I heard you on Scarborough Country, you had talked about quitting drinking, and 10 mm-hmm. years ago you had been, was it a car accident?
I drank into a blackout, as I often did, and I physically got up, but I didn't get back up into consciousness. But I went for a drive, and I drove into the Department of Water and Power, by the corner of Pico and Fairfax, and no one else was involved in the accident, but I broke both my arms, very badly. They had to have surgery on both of them, and my legs were damaged. They weren't broken, but they had to be in stabilizers, which are these, like, kind of ankle to thigh Velcro steel enforced socks so you can't bend your knees, because they were open to the bone, and so they sewed them up. So none of my limbs worked, and I was in a wheelchair in jail. And and I would periodically, since my arms didn't work, I couldn't hold on to the armrests of the wheelchair, and since my knees couldn't bend, they just sort of stuck straight out, and periodically just the weight of my body would pull me down gradually out of the wheelchair, and I would fall onto the floor of the jail, and my hospital gown would come up, and it would expose my private parts to everyone there. And then, you know, whoever was around, you know, guards or other folks, would just pick me up, put me back in my chair nicely. And it was then at that moment that I thought it was time to probably make a lifestyle change.
That may be the greatest opening to the show that we've done so far. How long were you in jail for?
Not long, under 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
You know, a day. I would have been in longer. You usually are in LA if you get a DUI.
Yeah.
But they were like, we can't take care of you. We're just going to bring you home. And then two cops brought me home to my apartment, And I remember my landlady was outside of the building when I got dropped off, and she saw the cops take me out of the back, and I'm in a bloody hospital gown in the leg stabilizers with arms that don't work. And I'm 6'3", and oh, my face is bloodied from the airbag, and so bruises and stuff on that. And she's looking at me just stock still with her mouth open, and there's cops on either side of me leading me back into my apartment, and I look at her and I go, "Everything's fine." So, yeah, that's how that unfolded.
I love the everything's fine when the elephant is just shitting all over the room. That is its own particular brand of sickness. Mm-hmm. Were you raised in a household where emotion and fear and pain wasn't kind of discussed?
Not really. I can't point to any of my behavior with booze and say, oh, you know, pin that on, you know, any bad habits that I was taught by my mom or dad. They're pretty good people. Everybody has their hang-ups, you know. Yeah. But no, you could say what you were thinking or feeling in my house, and, yeah, and it wouldn't be crushed. But you did bring up an interesting point, my saying everything was fine. I had been trying to quit drinking for years before that.
When did you first know you had a problem?
Early high school, like probably around 15. I got suspended around 15 or 16, for being drunk in school. And then the guidance counselors and the vice principal were like, "You should get help. You shouldn't be drunk in the day as a boy." And I thought, you know, relax. But then a few months later, I got like blackout drunk again. And then I thought, I don't want to be like this. And I remember thinking, I probably shouldn't drink, or I shouldn't drink so much. You know, I started to kind of wrestle with it. But one thing I want to say is that it's funny that, you know, my saying everything's okay, that was like, I knew clearly it wasn't okay, but it's good because, as I said, I had wanted to quit for so long, but it took getting to the point where I was so messed up that on sight, you could see that this was a person who needed real help, you know, like there was no way to hide it anymore.
Yeah. You know, I always say that alcoholism is the best prosecuting attorney ever, because it makes such a convincing case why you should have that next drink, why you're a piece of shit, why you should be in anxiety and doubt and fear, etc.
For sure.
And you will believe that voice because it warps reality, mm-hmm, to make you believe that. And until you are presented with a counter argument as powerful,
yeah,
you will continue to drink.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really lucky. I kind of symbolically, I had my arms were broken, both of them, you know, so I was quite powerless, and I needed that, you know. I needed people to look at me, to be able to see me from across the street at night in the rain and go, "That guy's a fuck up." Like, I needed, it had to be just open to the public, you know, like undisputably, this guy's a disaster. If he drinks, we're all in trouble.
Was the obsession to keep drinking, was that still there, even though you had known game over?
No, because I had wanted to quit. You know, it's like you want to quit, and then finally you're like, oh, I get it. I mean, really, I got to the point where, you know, especially with somebody who drinks a lot, you can be like, oh, well, sure, I might die. Who cares? Right. But when I realized, oh, wow, my drinking will kill other people if I keep drinking, then I was like, oh, I don't want to drink that bad. You know, I was like, because you get to the point where you don't care about yourself anymore. Yeah. And that's nobody's going to write about that in the paper.
Right.
But, you know, oh, really? The drunk guy drank until he died? Who cares? But if you kill other people, you know, I didn't want to be that. I liked everybody else. So
we were talking before we started rolling, and you were saying that you've battled depression, mm-hmm, for a long time. Can you kind of talk about that?
Sure.
And how it manifests itself?
Sure. I think the tendencies existed in the past. I can remember a couple dark episodes in my college years. But then after I quit drinking and had been sober for about a year, I think like the fight or flight syndrome kind of powered me through that first year of not drinking. And then once I finally, you know, months into sobriety, after all the court stuff was settled, which took months, plus I was sentenced to, I would have had to go to jail for quite a while because my, I drank, the blood alcohol level that they got out of me was 0.271.
Oh my God.
Which it's 0.08 is illegal in California. So 0.271, that's 3.5 times the legal limit. And that once you get over 0.20, they just double whatever the sentence would have been for a normal drunk, yeah. like a 0.15 or whatever.
Right.
So I had to go to classes for 6 months, and for 4.5 months, I was in the care of the state of California. I had the choice of jail for a while, or a month in rehab and 3.5 months in a sober living halfway house. Mm-hmm. I had not enjoyed jail in the brief time that I was there, so I chose
but
the other stuff.
But did you give it a chance, Rob?
Did I give jail? I gave it the college
a
try.
A lot of people don't give jail a good chance.
Yeah, you have to...
They judge!
I know. And I figured... Well, you know what it was? Is even when I was in... rehab was totally pleasant. But the halfway house I was in, there were people there who were just getting out of prison and stuff, and there were tough guys, and there was fighting, and both my arms were broken, so I really had to rely on, like, I had to shore up my mental defenses because I would sometimes have to, like, talk people out of beating me up. And
oh
so
my God.
I had to be like, well, let's think of some reasons why you shouldn't do that. And they'd be like, oh, whatever, and go beat somebody else up. But, like, so I forgot where I was going with that, but I,
We were talking about depression and how it manifests itself, right. And your history of it.
And anyway, I'm sure it'll all come back to that. But yeah, so for about a year into... Oh, right. The fight or flight syndrome is what I was saying. Yeah. So it's almost 6 months in living in places that were not a house or a home or an apartment. Mm-hmm. And then also all the classes that I was sentenced to, and then all the court stuff. And then all the surgeries, because I had to have surgeries on both my arms, and they did them one at a time so that I would have use of one arm at a time. Mm-hmm. So it was almost a year before I was like a regular dude working again and all that, and living in an apartment. And so after that, then my mind kind of fell apart. And went into, you know, I think what would be called like major depressive disorder, unipolar, you know, very, very bad suicidal depression, where I thought all the time of suicide, even though I was going to, you know, talk therapy and exercising and eating well and working out and not drinking and everything. I mean, I was living life reasonably well, you know, yeah. And
everything that you had control over to improve your mood, you were doing.
And so then I got depressed, and it was a lot worse than jail. I think about it this way. It's jail, you'll get out eventually, you know, a broken bone will knit. But depression or other mental disorders and stuff that's the worst, you know, that's the worst kind of, because that's like a prison cell that you carry around with you, you know, yeah. And so after a while...
You just need to not feel sorry for yourself, Rob. Don't you love one?
I try not to judge people who say stuff like that, you know, they don't understand, and that's fine. I'm glad that they don't. I wouldn't want people to, you know, my ultimate wish, when I was going through that, and it happened more than once, I had two major, like, smackdowns in the last 10 years, the most recent being, like, 3 or 4 years ago, around when we met. I think when you and I first met, I had been fine, but just even looking into your eyes threw me into a spiral. And
were you on meds at that point?
No, I started going. My psychologist said you should see a psychiatrist, and so I did. And
how did you get out of the first suicidal?
Medication. Oh, yeah, the first one.
So you sought medication.
It was so bad. I mean, I couldn't sleep at night.
Describe some of the thoughts and feelings that you had for, because there, I know there are listeners to this program that have never experienced depression and want to understand it better, or at the very least be entertained by other people's battles.
Yes, I know. And it's funny because as a comedian, I generally try to be entertaining, but right now I think it would be more useful to be honest about this.
Yeah.
Basically the symptoms for me of depression, and I can only speak to my own case, were quite physical. I couldn't sleep at all, and I normally sleep pretty well, but no sleeping at all. I would wake up in the morning and have diarrhea immediately.
Really?
Yep. I would go to brush my teeth, and when the bristles on the toothbrush touched my tongue, I would vomit. I felt physical pain constantly, like a thrumming physical pain throughout my body, and my thoughts were just kill yourself on a loop, and thought of different ways to do that, why I should do that, how the world would be way better if I did do that. And
what kept you from doing it? Because my God, the picture you paint.
Yeah, it very much sucked. What kept?
Did you have any kind of support system, a family or?
Yeah. I would talk to my family, who they live in Boston, and I would talk to them regularly because. The funny thing is that even though I had been a drunk for a long time before that, I was always like intellectually curious, and I read a lot. I loved to exercise even when I was drinking. I like to do new things. I like to travel, and be creative in various ways. So there was sort of, it was almost like, there were embers inside of me. I've always been like an optimistic person. And even though the physical symptoms of depression were unadulterated horror, there was somewhere where I felt like, first of all, let me say this. I would write down the way that I was thinking, and I'd be like, let's pretend that you're not you for a second. And I would look at them and I'd be like, that's crazy what you're writing. You know what I mean? Like, even though I might be envisioning my head being blasted apart by a shotgun or, drowning, I would think, you know what? I kind of am reviewing my life and I'm looking at people, and at no point can I find, people being like, you should definitely kill yourself, or like, oh, I wish you were dead. It wasn't, there might be people who didn't like me, but there wasn't like a large lobby.
This wasn't on a continuum. This was just kind of a...
Yeah, period. Now and again, somebody would be like, oh, fuck, I really wish you were a corpse. No, that, So I kind of was like, all right, look, let's, cause it can be good. Cause I still do. Everybody does. We think it's hard to step out of ourselves and, put ourselves in other shoes and look at ourselves. And so I thought, this seems crazy. So why don't I put it off and I'll do what these people are saying, which are stay in regular communication with the people that I care about, eat food, even though I don't want to, even if I throw it up, eat it anyway.
You literally had no appetite.
Oh, not at all. And sexually, I didn't even think about sex.
Yeah.
Not that I was attractive to women at that point. Like, I was like, I weighed like 40 pounds less. I'm not kidding. And was like, just, sunken eyed. I remember when they took one of my arms out of the casts, it was so skinny. And where they had put in a big plate in my forearm bulged out, and they took the cast off, and I just started to cry. I was like, I don't have a normal looking arm. Now, it took like 2 years to like put muscle back on it, like to be able to do a push up again. But now my arms, as far as I know, don't make people cry. I don't cry when I look at them. And so, it was awful. So I went to a psychologist. I went to talk therapy. And it would be good at this point to also mention that I lost my health insurance after the car accident. So I applied to three wonderful organizations that were just amazing. There was the MAP, the Musicians Assistance Program, Music Cares, which is like affiliated with the Grammys, both of them are actually, and then the Society of Singers. And each of them, because I didn't have health insurance, afforded me a little bit of dough to pay for therapy. And I even paid for my surgeries on credit cards. My second surgery I paid for with three credit cards, and it would take me years to pay this off. So I just mentioned that because...
Were you a musician before this?
I sang. That's what I studied in college. And so I did a lot of musical theater afterwards and stuff. And they were, and I had like made money making music. So that was enough for them, you know.
I see. And, but they wouldn't necessarily take anyone applying for
it. They wouldn't. Okay. But there might be some, you know. I mean, like, for example, and this is not a joke. One of my emergency room bill was huge, of course, because it wasn't just like a, yes, sew up his thing and send him on his way. It was like lots of cops, you know, multiple limbs being worked on, all kinds of crazy x-rays and stuff. And so that was a huge bill. And I remember bringing in, I was like, I can't pay for this. Or if I do, it's going to take years. So they were like, well, they had a special office for people who have no money that you could go to. And I went to them in the hospital and I brought, and this was like a year after the accident when I'm still negotiating with all my, and I know this is boring and you're probably like, I wish he would.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Because one of the things that contributes to the depression and the hopelessness sometimes is that you don't know a way out and you believe there is no way out. So this is perfect. This is great. This is exactly what people need.
Well, I just mentioned this because, like, if you host this podcast because you care about people and you've been through things yourself and you know, it's funny for like a person like you or I, and I'm sure lots of other people, you would much rather be caught in a bank robbery where bullets are flying than have to pay like a stack of bills. You know what I mean? Because like, oh, gunfire, hey, that was neat. You know, serotonin, I enjoyed that. But a stack of bills, you're like, oh, man, it's going to take all day.
It's like, you know? I always liken it to lifting anvils if lifting anvils also felt phony.
Yeah, exactly right. So I just say this because like the quagmire of all the crap you have to deal with, you know, and it's good. It, like if you get a DUI, you should be tied down and poked at with a stick. And there should be many levels of unpleasantness.
Yes.
But if it also is accompanied with, you know, like alcoholism and mental illness and stuff, you know, there's just ways to deal with that. You know, one ingredient is patience. Some days you should do nothing. If you're like, maybe I should go to my creditor's house and blow it up with a bomb, or just do nothing that day would be a good thing to do. Anyway, so I'm mentioning this long, boring, drawn out story because I went to them and I brought 3 years worth of tax returns to this office at the hospital. And they were like, wow, you're very much are broke. And so there's this group of nuns in Kansas. How insane is this? And they paid the bill for me.
What?
Now, the way that they found out about this is this, there was just like this philanthropic group that was looking for people to help and they contacted this office. So I mention that because that's insane, right? And you would never think, oh, maybe some nuns in Kansas will pay my bills, you know? But sometimes things like that happen. And so, like, it can also be in depression. You'll be like, oh, nothing good will ever happen to me.
Yeah.
You don't know. Maybe nothing ever good will. But also, maybe nothing ever bad will. Or bad ever will. I'm not good at words. But you know what I mean? Like, you can't see the future.
You can't predict it. You can't. And the universe is so complex.
Yeah.
Trying to predict how it's going to unfold, it is not only illogical, it's the height of arrogance.
It was arrogant, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's wrong. And so you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. There's going to be good stuff, bad stuff. They're both going to happen, so chill out, asshole, and, you know.
Yeah, maybe try to focus on the good stuff.
Yeah, you know, because we have magnifying minds, and what we focus on grows, so.
And then you extrapolate it out into the future, and, you know, there is few things worse than the combination of imagination and pessimism.
Oh, good God. No. And pessimism just doesn't make sense. You know, I don't proselytize. I don't try to convert people to my way of thought, whatever it is. It's not like I have some big elucidated belief system. But, you know, pessimism just doesn't work. Doesn't make sense ultimately in the final analysis.
Yeah, it may feel cool, especially when you're in your 20s, because you don't risk anything by being pessimistic. But it's ultimately it's a dead end street, and it just kind of somebody had one time had an analogy for like hitting your bottom smoking weed, and they said it's like getting kicked to death by a rabbit. And I feel like pessimism is kind of that way too. You don't lose a big chunk immediately, but it just like sandpaper wears away at the joy of life.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Yeah. So you've had this, you were diagnosed then as being what?
I think major depressive disorder or unipolar, whatever. Mm-hmm. And
they put you on meds?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they put me on an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And
did that work?
It did. It did work.
Can you talk about what before and what we heard before? Can you talk about what you began to feel when the meds started working?
You know, what's funny is like the only like for me, there's not side effects to these drugs that I'm really aware of that I don't deal with. But one weird thing that happened, I remember like after like a day, after the first or second day, I remember felt like I got struck by lightning, and I had a memory of walking to catch the bus home from middle school. And it was like, and I was there walking down Village Street in Marblehead, Massachusetts, and like all the smells and sights and everything. And that was like, whoa, something's happening up in Synapse Town.
Wow.
And it only happened once, but that's like one of three major weird things that have ever happened in my brain, you know, that, you know, could have been a small stroke. I don't know. But, then I remember very slowly after that, I never noticed anything weird again after that, other than I very gradually felt better. My poops began to become more solid, less diarrhea.
Always a fan of less diarrhea.
Always. I vomited less and less, brushing my teeth. The physical pain in my body slowly went away.
By the way, I love the catch-22 of vomiting, brushing your teeth. You vomit, exactly. Then you need to brush your teeth again.
I know. And I'm not a model. You know, I was skinny at that point, too, so I didn't need to be vomiting. But so that happened. Oh, you know, and I noticed women again. I remember jerking off for the first time after like 6 weeks or something.
Yeah.
And being like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Yeah. And, you know, never, I hope I'm never depressed again because I love to masturbate. but unless you live in a monastery and you're actively meditating towards enlightenment, you know, like in this life or something, then you should be sexual if you're a person. There's no where to stuff that down. If it's not, that should be healthy. That's kind of like a canary in a coal mine type of thing. Like, you should want to fuck people. You should want to jerk off. Not all the time. It shouldn't dominate your life. But, like, if your sex is off, you know, people need to get their fuck on. Yeah. And so I do think it is sort of a litmus test as to...
My mom has that crocheted on the wall.
Yeah, you need to get your fuck on. Yeah. And yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Is that on Etsy?
It is. So fast forward to, the meds are working.
Yes.
You're sober.
Yep.
What then is the next battleground in Rob's head?
I mean, after that, it's, let's see.
Or is there none?
No, I mean, there was a second depressive episode several years later.
Even though you were on the meds?
Well, we dialed it down, and so I was on less. Because there's the thing where, like, look, I wish I didn't have to take pills each morning, you know? And so, you know, ego will come in, and I'll be like, hey, I've been feeling good for a while, why don't I, you know, and...
Is there anybody that doesn't go through that, that's on meds? Everybody, I think, does that.
Not that I've met or spoken to.
Really?
Know? No, that's what I'm saying. I don't know anyone. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, everybody at some point tries to go off of
it. Right. And that didn't work. You know, and then the second episode that I had was as bad or worse by a little bit than the first. And it was... It's interesting because I needed health insurance, right? After these surgeries, I was like, Jesus Christ, United States of America, I need health insurance. Right. So I got a shitty job that had benefits, and I started working at a company. I got a job as an accounting temp, right? And then I got hired to be some ad sales guy's assistant at this company, and then they wound up creating MySpace. So it was working in the .com wackiness. I had health insurance, and I gradually just sort of failed upward in this company. I would get passed around from department to department till I wound up being, I think, a director of business development for a division of the company. And so I was buying and selling ads and making a lot of money. And I had an office in a skyscraper, and it was crazy, and I didn't like it.
Yeah, no enjoyment.
No, I hated it a lot. And
what did you feel? You felt like you should be doing something creative?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I went to college. I mean, I had been, my first professional acting gig was when I was 17. So at this point, 26, 27, 28, 29. So I kind of in the wilderness, you know, as far as, you know, my life path viewed from now would look like. I mean, I'm glad it all happened during that time. I got married, which was awesome. And, you know, a lot of good things happened, but professionally, I fucking hated what I did.
Yeah.
And so around a little over four years ago now, I was like, fuck it. This one company, I was now at a makeup company. I had left that company, and two companies later, I'm director of business development for a makeup company, and kind of like took them online. And so that was, didn't enjoy it. And so I decided when that company folded and they laid me and a bunch of other people off, I was like, I'm a comedian now. And yeah. So, I mean, I'd been doing lots of improv and stand up, but I was like, this is all I'm going to do.
And you had enough money saved up that you could, could make the leap.
Yeah. And, I went through that very quickly. So I had money and it was great. And my wife was like, give it a shot. And, then after a little while we were like, okay, so I've spent all the money that I saved. And it sold like, yeah, I mean, I was getting my real estate license. I took all the classes, but then just kept pushing the test back. I was taking investment classes at UCLA Extension. Mm-hmm. I read probably 30 books on all kinds of investing and real estate investing. I was looking at like duplexes and triplexes to buy and stuff. Crazy stuff that now I look back, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that didn't happen. Anyway, so I started doing comedy and doing shows every night, you know, and writing and trying to get hired on shows and stuff, putting together the packet and all that. And it was hard, as it is, of course, you know. Yeah. And I was fortunate to be able to kind of rely on I hit the ground running in the sense that I had performed a lot in the years past across a variety of, you know, formats. I had been on TV. I had been cut out of movies. Mm-hmm. I had done a lot, you know, hundreds of improv shows in Hollywood. I had done toured the country and doing musical theater and stuff. So I was very comfortable on stage, you know, but I had to still, there's no shortcut. So it took a lot of work. And after a while, reducing my medication, then I was just like, whoa, what's happening here? And I got into another depression. So we adjusted the medication and did some experimenting, which was incredibly painful. And then
it's the worst. Being between meds is the fucking worst. Because you're going through the withdrawal of the one that that you're trying to get off of, and you're experiencing the side effects of the new one. Because a lot of drugs you will acclimate to, but there may be months of sleeplessness or a month of sleeplessness with the new one. And on top of that, you're not even sure either decision is going to work.
Yeah.
And you may be back at square one 2 months after that.
So you gotta be patient and you gotta take care of yourself during that time. I just flashed to during the first depressive episode that I had, I read the book when I couldn't sleep. Because if you can't sleep, I don't know if people know this, if you're lying in bed and you can't sleep, fucking get out of bed. You know, don't. Plus, you don't want to like associate your bed with sleeplessness. So I'd go read. And I remember one book I read that really helped me a lot was called Carter Beats the Devil by Glenn David Gould, about this magician around the turn of the last century. It was so weird and good and detailed and beautiful. I remember that book. That book is like a good friend to me. It was like a book that held my hand when I was really having
Isn't
a tough time.
Isn't that awesome when you find something like that?
Yeah.
The Beatles anthology book was that for me.
Yeah, it's funny. And by on the flip side of that coin that I would also like to add is like, if you do deal with depression, and this also happens, I know, to victims of sexual abuse and stuff like this, there are some things that you should take care of yourself by just not absorbing and not paying attention to. Like, you know, like I don't really want to spend, I don't want to like make the deposit into my mind of reading too much about like suicide and other stuff like that. I try to fight it. I might say the words suicide a lot, but it's always in the goal of trying to help people not do it, you know?
So what you're saying is the thing that you find to distract or entertain yourself or to be good to yourself, make sure that it's not kind of feeding what it is you're trying to get away from.
For example, like William Styron wrote a book called Darkness Visible about depression. And I've heard people read that who'd be like, oh yeah, wow, really paints a picture. I don't think you should read that if you deal with depression. I would like to go back and unread it.
Read something lighter, like Sophie's Choice.
Exactly. Except it's funny that you say that, because like literally read Sophie's Choice instead. Because although there might be some people who commit suicide in that book, it's just about other stuff. It's not just about depression. So like you can consume enough writing and film and whatever about depression if you have depression. You can reach your limit. And so I would say be careful with that stuff.
Yeah, because while you do want information to help you understand what it is that you're going through, you also need something to kind of escape from it.
Yeah.
You seem to be a person that doesn't do five. You do zero or ten with things.
I often wish that wasn't the case in certain things. You know, I have to be a comedian who is very grateful to be making his living from comedy. I have done some, you know, sort of self-analysis, and I have character traits that are responsible for putting me where I am, some of which are positive and some of which are negative, you know, and obsessive and weird.
Yeah, I heard you on the Sklarbro talking about when Twitter first came out. You have how many Twitter followers?
Right now I have like 260 something thousand, I think.
That's fucking amazing.
It's ridiculous.
And you built them up the hard way. People didn't know necessarily who you were. It's not like you were a celebrity that people followed over.
No,
you,
I was not.
You just tweeted funny shit consistently every single day.
Well, thank you for saying that. I will say, yeah, whether you like or don't like what I tweet, and there are certainly plenty who don't, I did build that house myself, as it were, you know? And I do that too much. I still do it too much, you know? My wife will be like, put that fucking phone down, and she's the correct one. I don't hear that, and I'm like, oh, you nag. I'm like, oh, you normal human, you're correct, you know, thank you for saying that.
How often do you say the right thing to her and recognize that she's right?
I'm getting better at it. I mean, there's great things about being married and being in a relationship with somebody for a long time where you do get better. Things about the other person that you're like, oh, if that were a physical part of them, I would cut it off with a bone saw. You literally grow to realize that that's actually the person that you must need to be with, because they have a lesson that you can really use, you know? So my wife is fucking awesome. And if we come to, you know, a disagreement about something, she's very frequently the correct one. I mean, I am too sometimes. I'm not some like mouth-breathing idiot in the corner being washed by her with a hose and brush being like, be fit for the world. You know, I mean, she's a person too, but she's been very helpful. Even in things that are shitty about her. That's what's so great about marriage is like, everything that you do for each other can be a gift, even if it's awful.
Can you talk about, and I don't know if this is a difficult thing to discuss, but what the for somebody out there who lives with somebody mm-hmm. who has depression, do you have any advice?
I would say...
Or any type of mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, anything, you know, patience in this time is going to be very, very helpful, you know. You're not... Patience with that person. You can't fix them, you know, so you owe it to both of you to encourage them to talk to other people. You owe it to them to leave for 8, 12, 24 hours at a time if you want and go hang out with your much more enjoyable friend to be with, Susie. Yeah. You know, you have to take care of you at that time, because the person living with a depressed person is going through a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
So you have to be good to you. You have to kind of go through the sort of finances of your relationship and look at all the good deposits that depressed person might have made in the past and been like, oh yeah, that time we went to New Hampshire, that was fun. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? That time he surprised me at work with flowers or whatever, you know, that, I mean, like, you literally have to be like, oh yeah, even though this person is tremendously unattractive, just repellently awful right now,
yeah.
You have to sort of take the long view and realize that this is one of those difficult times that you knew you would go through when you signed up for a human relationship.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, patience, love, and
know that you are dealing with someone whose reality is being warped,
yeah.
but believes that that is reality, that warpedness.
Yeah.
And so give them a little bit of... Try not to judge the fact that they are seeing everything through a funhouse mirror.
Yeah, and you know, by the same token, much like the way you would deal with an alcoholic or whatever, they still have to adhere to normal human standards. They might be, quote, sick, they might be hurting, but they should still eat the fucking meal that you made. They should still bathe, you know what I mean? Like, you can't...
They should do what they have control over to try to better themselves.
Yeah.
If they are just going to sit, you know, on the couch for years in self-pity...
Then get out.
Then fucking absolutely get out. But a lot of people don't know where, and I'm not saying that I know where that line is, but, it, you know, there is a line somewhere between mm-hmm. when you stick with somebody and when you don't. But if you're not talking about it with somebody, you're never going to find where that line is.
Right. And do you see that forward motion in them? Do you see them wanting to get better? Right. If you do, then, you know, stick around for as long as you feel like it, really. You know, that's what I'd say.
So what... what are the battles that you're dealing with nowadays, if you have any?
Well, I mean, I'm a dad, and I'm a husband, and those are the most important things, you know? So one thing that's weird about having a kid is, like, your capacity to love another thing is violently stretched out, and that's uncomfortable, you know? I mean, like, you literally, I wish that I loved my son less sometimes, you know what I mean? Because it's like, are you shitting me? Like, the amount of feeling that you can feel towards another person, it's true what they say.
That's got to make you feel really vulnerable, because you're like, what if something happens to this person I have all this emotion invested in? Oh, exactly.
No, literally, like, my wife and I are like, we have to have more. Now you understand why, like, Settlers had 12 kids, because four of them were going to die. Like, and I'm not kidding. You know, it's sort of funny to say that, but I very much am like, we got to have more now.
Yeah. How many kids do you have?
One.
One.
Yeah. So and we definitely need to have more.
Plans for more?
Yes. We would like to have more. And
your career has taken off since you've, I think you may be one of the first examples of somebody, having a writing career, kind of take off from Twitter.
Yeah. I'm very lucky, because of that, because, like, I was trying to get hired on every show you can name I was submitting to, and, you know, I'd go through different, get to different levels with each of them, you know, and some of them would be like, hey, fantastic, you know, or we're not hiring now, or we're gonna whatever, or fuck you, you suck, it out of here, you know, but they're different things. And so I was like, you know what, I'm gonna just write anyway. I'm gonna write for me. If other people like it, great. My kind of motivator was like, you don't have to think that I'm funny, but if you say that I don't work hard, then I'll punch you in your figurative face.
Yeah.
Not literal, because I abhor violence. Yeah. But I will draw a picture of your face and punch it if you say it. So the work ethic had to be there. The funny, hope so, you know? Yeah. And so that's... So gradually that did turn into jobs. Yeah, I did, because of that, get hired to write on different television shows and magazines and stuff. And so...
And you're currently employed right now?
It's kind of weird. Nominally, yeah. I just delivered a pilot to Comedy Central that I shot and, you know, wrote and produced. And
awesome.
So that was great. And then I'm writing a book under contract right now.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm very, very lucky and happy because of those things. But, you know, the nature of this podcast, but I found out about the book deal and the pilot deal. Both. I found out about the pilot. Mm-hmm. Then a few days later, found out about the book deal. Then literally not a week, but 3 days later, my son was born. And then 3 days after that, sold the pilot. So
wow.
My life changed very dramatically in the earlier part of this year. And I am glad that it all happened around the birth of my son, because he's more important than any of those things. You know, they're absolutely great and very important. Right. But speaking of like depression and alcoholism and stuff, you know, people like me can freak out over good news too, you know? And so I'm glad that I had that my son was born, because
when you say people can freak out about good news, how do you mean?
Like, you can be like go nuts, you know, you can get high, you can go on a spending spree, you can...
Because you want more of that good feeling.
Yeah, you can screw it up, you know, I mean, so easy to screw up opportunities. So that's cool. Oh, and then another thing that I was going to say about when my son was born, I remember being at the hospital and being like, holy shit, I am definitely going to die. Because you realize, like, oh, you just saw a life begin, yeah. And you kind of get in touch with, like, beginnings and endings, and you're in a hospital. And I was like, I'm super definitely going to die. And that was comforting. No, I mean, it wasn't, like, I mean, I knew, and I had even, you know, flirted certainly with death in the past, but knowing, seeing a life start was like, whoa, life will also end. And so enjoy it while you've got it. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. And I think you are a great example of what can happen if somebody decides to face their challenges head on and say to themselves, what do I have to do that can make this better? What do I have control over? Well, I'm going to put the best effort forward I can over those things and then hope that the universe is going to help me with the rest of those.
Well, thanks. You know, I try to look at it. I try not to be a victim of dualistic thought. Things aren't good or bad. That I really shouldn't drink alcohol, that's not good or bad. You know, let's call it alcoholism to have it be simple. Alcoholism isn't bad. Accepting it or not accepting it, that would be where a bad could come in. You know, I have it, so don't drink. You know, depression, I got to treat it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't want to hate it. I don't hate alcoholism. I don't hate depression. You know, they're powerful forces. I respect them, you know, but I got to listen to them so that I can be of use, you know?
And ultimately, I think that's really the best peace comes from feeling of use that I've found.
Yeah, you got to work, you know? I think Chekhov said, somebody asked him, like, why are we here? And he was like, oh, to work. And I agree with that. We're not here to relax. You eat pie. You should eat pie, but we're here to work.
Yeah. Well, Rob Delaney, thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. I know you got somewhere you got to go to, but thank you.
Thank you for very much. By. Thanks having me, Paul. And I'm going to go get
the door. I cannot believe it has been 8 years since we recorded that episode. There's still a little bit more of that episode to go, but I want to give a couple of shout outs to our sponsors for this week. Today's episode is sponsored by Crazed. It's a new podcast created by the National Mental Health Innovation Center, and it highlights big new ideas in the world of mental health, from how to transform mental health treatment to prevention and stigma reduction, and the visionaries behind these ideas. The two hosts are Matt Vogel and Rick Reckedahl. Matt is the
founder and executive director of the NMHIC and also a former professional stand-up. And Rick is, or was, the senior executive at DreamWorks Animation. And their guests are familiar with the impact of mental health, both personally and professionally. And you'll find compelling stories, information about cutting-edge mental health technology, and just great dialogue about difficult issues. Guests include policymakers, nonprofit leaders, researchers, technologists, filmmakers, and more. And the ideas and stories presented on Crazed are the kind that you dig and will probably be talking about long after you've heard the episode. So you can find Crazed anywhere you get your podcasts or on crazedpodcast.com. Subscribe and listen today. Today's episode is also sponsored by Squarespace. Turn your dream into a reality with Squarespace. They make it easier than ever to launch your passion project. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers and the ability to customize just about anything with a few clicks. You can easily make a beautiful website yourself, and I've done it. It's super intuitive. It's simple. I did one to host my musical snippets and pictures I've taken of dogs. It's paul-gilmartin.squarespace.com, and I'll put a link to that under the show notes for this if you want to see it, but it's nice. Squarespace is just a great product. Their e-commerce functionality, it lets you sell anything online, and analytics help you grow your site in real time. Everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. Check it out. Head to squarespace.com/mental for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code MENTAL to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/mental and also offer code MENTAL. And now the rest of the episode from 2011. Website, as I've mentioned for the show, is mentalpod.com. There's a forum there. There's the surveys you can take. You can support the show non-financially is going to iTunes and giving us a good rating and a good review. That boosts our ranking, and that brings more people to the show. And the show has been growing a little bit every week. And that's really cool. It's really nice to know that that people are enjoying what we do here. And that really brings a smile to my face, especially on the days when I'm feeling a little down. And I have to say, since I've gone back on Celexa, the last show that we did, I kind of mentioned that I was in this really dark place where suicide wasn't becoming a reality, but I was starting to fantasize about it a little bit. And I knew that was the darkness talking. And so I went back on Celexa. I'm feeling great. And I've just had a really good week of feeling like I am enough. And that is such a great place to be. It takes work. It takes fucking work sometimes to get there and to stay there. And I never stay there. I always slide back. But knowing that I can get to that place is so comforting, to know that it is possible to have moments, even days, even weeks or months of feeling like I am enough, I have enough, and I'm doing enough. And I know that sounds kind of new agey, but that's the fucking truth. So let's take it out with a survey respondent. His name is Jimmy. He's straight. He's in his 20s. The environment he was raised in was a little dysfunctional. He's never been the victim of sexual abuse. His darkest thoughts that I will... It says, not things that you would act on, but things you're ashamed to admit you think about. He says that I will kill my pets, that I will hurt my wife. And what are your deepest, darkest secrets, things you have done, things that have happened to you? He writes, when I was a teenager, I masturbated a lot, often in inappropriate places. And then, do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes that I was stupid and that someone had to have seen me. Maybe it's just my take, Jimmy, but I wonder how anybody can get through their teenage years not masturbating in an inappropriate place. I'm just going to list some of the places I remember jerking off. Not where people could see me. It was usually dark. It was usually at night. Sometimes during the day when, nobody's around. But backyard, driveway, beach, into Lake Michigan. Sorry, anybody that's drinking Lake Michigan water. There's filters.
I wonder how many listeners I'm losing right now. And maybe the one that comes closest to making me feel a lot of shame was in a van of friends coming home from skiing in Colorado in high school. Everybody was asleep, and it's just those teenage hormones were just raging. And, you know, I had a bunch of blankets covering me, so nobody could see anything, and everybody was knotted out anyway. But, yeah, there you have it. You know what? It might be easier to actually list the places I didn't jerk off as a teenager. Church, Wrigley Field, and the Hoover Dam. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, you're feeling ashamed, you're feeling self-hatred, let it go. And if you can't let it go, get some help. Because there is help and there is hope, and you are not alone. Thanks for listening.